Hello and welcome to another episode of Football Memories and Moments. This is the eighth, it could be the final. We're not too sure, we're hoping to pick up one or two more, but I think if we don't, then I'm really pleased with how this series has gone, and thanks again to everybody that's listened and to all our guests as well. This week we're joined by Rob Palmer. Rob's one of the most famous football commentators that you'll have heard, in the sense of he's covered all the games that you've watched, Spanish football for Sky Sports, local football for Granada. He's a former player as well. Not many people might have known that, and that's where we come to for his memory, where we think about players who make the jump to media, kind of do it in one stage and then a second stage. But as you'll come to listen, Rob did that in one go, which was incredible, and pretty much set up most of his career. And then for his moment, we're going to come on and look at something that goes from, I'm loath to say, from a high to a low, because we were joined by Rob's son, Ellis, who's available on Twitter at EllisPalmer94. And I think there you can learn far more about Ellis than I can tell you over a microphone. But it was talking about commentating at the World Cup and then all of a sudden having to get home. And it was fantastic listening to Rob and the love and pride he's got for his son, who was making him proud on a daily basis. So it was great to catch up with Rob on the Wirral. He's quite local to me, and I really enjoyed it, and I hope you do too.
Well, I suppose the most significant memory for me would be the late summer, early autumn of 1988. I just joined Radio Humberside as a reporter from an agency, and I had to take the leap into news reporting, which meant that at the age of 23, I was giving up my aspirations of playing football. I'd been a pro at Derby, I played a really decent non-league level, and I moved to Hull, my hometown, to work as a news reporter, which meant working weekends. They sent me out to interview the manager of Bridlington Town, a guy called Colin Appleton, who'd played in the cup final, famous manager, had been at Hull. And he says to me, "You know, what are you doing these days? Are you still playing?" And I said, "Well, ironically, I've had to give it up because of this job." And he said, "Listen," he said, "my goalkeeper's been banned for 8 games for headbutting a linesman, and I'm desperate for a goalkeeper. Could you come and play for us?" So we did a little deal with the local radio station, Radio Humberside, and they said I could have weekends off in return for publicity, and they'd do a little story around it on the breakfast show and things like that. So I was back in the football frame, but also I was within the media sphere, which is where my career was going to go. So I went down, trained with them, and we got drawn in the FA Cup to Cletermore Celtic, which was then, that year certainly, the northernmost team in the FA Cup, just on the Scottish border. And we played, and we went, stayed overnight, all the kind of pro treatment. And the night before the game, John Motson turned up. He's obviously a hero of mine as an aspiring commentator. And you know, you have a drink in the bar with John and get to know him. And John did the report. We beat Cletermore Celtic. And then the idea is then that the BBC follow a team through every round of the FA Cup to the final. So we beat them. The producer called me up at the time, a guy called Brian Barwick, who went on to greater things, and said, "Look, just kind of trying to get some ideas of who might have interesting jobs, the characters in your team, and the backstory of Bridlington Town." So I filled him in, and then I said cheekily at the end, "Who's doing your reporting?" And because it was just the start of the Seoul Olympics, all of the BBC reporters were away or otherwise engaged on stuff. And he said, "Well, we're just going to get a local freelance." I said, "Well, you know, I'm working up here now. If there's any chance I could get some work experience." And he laughed and he put the phone down. Half an hour later, got a call back. And he said, it's Brian, what a great idea. We'll follow you for a week, reading the news bulletins, going out, doing the news stories. We'll follow you in goal on the day. We'll send a camera crew and a producer. And you know, you'll be the crux of the story." So you know, I'd landed on my feet. And they sent a guy called Philip Burney, who I believe now is up there on the hierarchy of BBC Sport. But this was his first ever shoot. So he wanted to make this really, really happen. He came down from London with ideas, and he was bristling with all these, you know, enthusiasm. So we were filming all over Bridlington, and we did stuff. And I think, to this day, I've got the video. It's either North Shields or Gateshead. Jim Pearson, the former Everton striker, was the manager up there. It was grim. It was cold. We did the reporting. And we drew with them. So then we brought them back to our place in Bridlington. It was the days of replays, which kids won't believe now. And we drew with them again. So this went to a fourth game. So by the fourth game, they had enough trust in me not to send a producer this time. I kind of learnt the ropes and everything. And part of the filming was Colin Appleton taking me aside, the manager, into his office and saying, look, you know, you've played eight games for us. You've conceded only three goals. I was a goalkeeper. You've been magnificent, but you knew the deal. This guy's on contract. He gets paid every week, come what may. You've been helping us out, and I'm so sorry, but you dropped, which made great television. and I'm hamming it up to the camera because I knew what was coming. So they filmed it. So this has added to the story now. It's a 4-3 play. I've been dropped. I've been a bit of a star of it. I've been saving. I've had five clean sheets in eight games. I was there on merit. So we went out and we did the tackiest piece to camera, but it was wonderful where I was there on the pitch and my goalkeeping gloves, you know, you can see it on YouTube. I mean, it's when they were tight.
Yeah.
And you've got the mullet and everything. And I'm saying, you know, well, I've been the goalkeeper through the three games. But it's time, as you've seen in the chat with the manager, for me to say goodbye to the goalkeeping gloves. And then what you do, you lock off the camera in exactly the same position. Go inside, get a shower, do my hair, put the suit on, collar and tie. They station you in exactly the same position. And then cut into it and hello to the TV microphone. So my career was launched. So it was great. So that was like the moment where I went from somebody who wanted, and probably still at the age of 23, thought I might get back into the professional game as a player, into the TV. And then it added to that because they asked me to go down. They cut it down there and edited it down in London. And my job was to come in and add the voiceover at the end to the finished pictures. So I went down there. And even then, it didn't end because we went down and it was the night that Linford Christie was accused of taking some kind of ginseng tea or something, and it was a big drug scandal. So we went down, was expecting to be half an hour in a voiceover booth. Everybody was disposed. I didn't get to do the voiceover till 1 o'clock in the morning. Is my introduction to television. Got to meet Des Lynam very, very briefly. Got back because the next day I was on Radio Humberside shift about 7 o'clock in the morning. So I literally didn't sleep all night. Went in, did the news shift. Actually had to go sleep in one of the studios halfway through the shift. And eventually it was shown on Football Focus on Grandstand. And it was the great line. It's 15 minutes long, which is incredible because most of my features these days on Sky, three and a half minutes long. 15 minutes long on Grandstand. And it finished with Des Lynam kind of twizzling his moustache and saying, watch out, Bob Wilson, he's after your job. So if you're looking for my kind of abiding memory, that was it, because that was the transitional moment in my life where I went from being kind of a rookie journalist and somebody who wasn't quite good enough to be a footballer, somebody whenever I went for a job and they say, what have you done? I just throw a VHS out on the desk and it was as good as anything.
Before we even get on to deconstructing all of that, I mean, there's a lot going on there. Not only it's like you've got, the, as you say, Brian Barwick, a person who's pretty much at the top of sport, I think ITV and Sky.
He was BBC and then he was FA.
Yeah. And then he's launched a, didn't he launch a football degree at Burnley as well?
I think so. He's everywhere.
Yeah. So you've got that. You've got the person who's now, as you say, a bit of a bigwig at the BBC.
Yeah.
And then you've got, if you got the chance to sit down and design, right, well, that's obviously not going to happen, but I need to start that. What is the most Hollywood way I can set up an end to one career in the beginning of the, I'm going to do it.
Yeah. It doesn't get any better than that, really. You know, and to this day, we've done a couple of things recently and some people know that I played football, and a lot of people that know me, you know, pre 23, 24 years of age and know me as somebody who's a decent footballer. And obviously since then, people know me as an average broadcaster, or this is what I do. So it's quite nice, that transitional moment. But it was good because I learned everything, because I was still new to radio. I'd been a written journalist and I'd worked for an agency, and I was still learning the skills of radio. And all of a sudden I'm thrown into a top lad, and I love Football Focus and Saint and Greavesy and On the Ball, and you know that's my kind of thing. That's what I do now with Soccer Saturday, and I was a scholar of those. So to be thrown into it, to see how they shoot it, how they edit it, how they construct it, and then to learn how to do a piece to camera, and then go in and do the voiceover. It was great listening to the voiceover because it's an incredibly Hull accent that I still had back then, very flat vowels. But it's great, you know. I'd done a 4-year degree in America in mass media communication, but that kind of 2 or 3 week period just taught me so much.
I mean, it is incredible. But the other aspect to it as well, you may have been thrown in the deep end of football reporting, but you were also thrown in the deep end of getting straight back into being a player. And
yeah, I genuinely thought I'd finished. Actually, I mean, it did go on a bit after that because I think the next season, and I was working in sport, and I'd been at Chesterfield When I played football for Derby County, didn't make it, which is another big moment. Went off to America, played over there. But I'd gone to Chesterfield when I was 18 on trial, and then the youth coach there, Bill Green, who ironically turned me down at Chesterfield, turned up at Scunthorpe United as assistant manager. One day I went down to Scunthorpe to do the interviews with a manager, a guy called Mick Buxton, and Bill's like, well, what are you doing now? Well, I'm doing this. And he said, well, you know, short of a keeper, I've only got one. They only carried one goalkeeper then in the third and fourth division. And I ended up going and training with Scunthorpe every Thursday morning. I actually got the call then to go play for the Scunthorpe reserve team. The following season, we played the likes of, you know, I played at West Brom, and we played at Villa, and we played up at Darlington and Middlesbrough, places like that. So it was a transit. I was still kind of, sometimes when I dream now, I still think somebody's going to give me a call. I'm going to get one more game somewhere along the way.
It is all about, I mean, it's I always like it. I mean, myself, with this is the second Keepers Union podcast that we've done. Spoke to David Priest, and, you know, yeah, David's great, and now obviously yourself. It is, I play in goal as well, and I didn't play for a year. And I did notice that my sporting dreams were about just making that one more great save.
Yeah.
So when you've decided to make that choice of going into journalism, the weekend career, you know, that's the biggest thing. You know that regardless of what you're going to do, it is going to be a weekend career one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So to get that extra shot again, that what was that sensation like?
Do you know, it was quite nice in that it had rounded it up, I suppose, because it was a real dilemma to have to give up football. I mean, you know, you talk about the eureka moments when I came back. To give you a bit of background, I played at Derby. I was one of those kids that was the greatest thing when I was 14, 15, went to Derby County at that point, 4 years before I signed, 79, being the champions of England. So, you know, it's like signing for Chelsea, City, United, mm-hmm. Liverpool. Now they were the Archie Gemmells and the Roger Davises, and people like that were knocking around. So I was at Derby, didn't make it. And then I went to America and then kind of came back and still hung on to those hopes. But the eureka moment was when I was looking for a journalism job, and I was at Grimsby Town, and they drew Arsenal, I think it'd be right to say, in the FA Cup. And all the lads, oh, great, we're going to get another year's contract out of this. We're going to be okay now. And I thought, is this going to be my existence forevermore? Kind of getting to January and hoping that come March, April, May, I can get another 12 months at that level. And I realised that if I was lucky, I was going to play at that level. And that was the eureka moment where I then went into local newspapers in the Midlands. But then, you know, having done that and made that stride, I thought any chance of any football glory was behind me. Played a bit of non-league football, but all of a sudden, he's you know, probably one of the pinnacles. I played at Old Trafford, and we played some massive games in America, but it just gave you that one final hurrah, which is a great way to just say goodbye to it.
So you were mentally okay with being dropped for that 4-3 play?
Oh yeah.
What? Did they get beat or did they go through?
They went. Do you know what? I can't remember. They went off to the next round.
So they did get, because
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah, there was
we as keepers, yeah, you know.
There was one more round and they lost in the next round. I think we won, and I think they, if I'm right, probably history might prove me wrong, but I think they in the next round. But I think the following season with pretty much the same team, I might be wrong, but I think they got to the Wembley of whatever it was at that level. They were Northern Premier rather than Conference. But I'm sure it was like a great team. The backstory, and they kept using the pitches for years to come because the guy that owned the club was called Ken Richardson. He's a bit of a local character, and he was the guy that took over Doncaster and got jailed for burning down the stadium.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So Ken was all over the piece as well. So when the BBC were running pitches for years to come about this guy who'd been jailed for burning down a football stadium, there were these pictures where me and him walking around Queensgate, come back to me, Bridlington Town's ground. So he had another life after that.
I like the way that you know, I don't think there's many other industries or ways of life in this country where character can be used in such a euphemistic way, because when you said his name, I thought, is he the bloke? And then you said it.
Yeah, he's safe to say he burned it down because he was jailed. So
Don't worry about that. but coming back to that whole event, then, I mean, it is the mix of I mean, even meeting John Motson and things like that. Is that as much as you thought that those games may have given you another shot at being a pro?
No, it rounded it off for me. Right. I realised that, you know, I realised that I had to make a career, and this was the kickstart I wanted, because, you know, from that, I was working in news. I wanted to work in sport, and I'd been given a news job. But then I realised, well, with this, at the age of 23, my lads 23, 24, and he's at the BBC now. If he had something like this to take to his next job, it gives you a head start on the other. So I think, hold on, I'm 23, I've got a degree from America, I'm working for a newspaper, I've been working for a newspaper, got loads of experience. This is the time now to leap ahead of the others that are kind of my age. So it was great. It's like, oh, thanks very much. That's been brilliant. I've had a great education, and I've had an early education in the BBC, and I've made a bit of a name for myself. So no, it was it was great. It was harmonious.
The beauty of it is, though, is that that's not been the... I'm going to assume, because, I mean, again, I'm going to show my age towards you a little bit, but I mean, I'm still, you know, coming up to 40, but yeah. I think I've been listening to you pretty much most of my adult life. In fact, no, all of my adult life. And I always remember, because of, I think you had some sort of association with Tranmere.
Uh-huh.
I grew up on the Wirral, and you've obviously spent a lot of time here now. But your career hasn't been downhill from there, really, has it? You know, you know, if you had to stop tomorrow, you could look back on that career.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Really well.
Oh yeah, I mean, and everything, you know, when you say choose one moment, you could give me a year or name a football team, and there would be some pivotal moment. I mean, the love with Tranmere is. Actually, the first time I came to Tranmere, we came up here to do a game with Grimsby Town as for Ready Humberside. As soon as we got here, we found that we were on strike at the BBC, apparently. And Tranmere looked after us, took us in the boardroom, fed us, because we weren't working. Had a few beers in, you know, the baths there. Yeah. And it's the first time I'd ever been to Merseyside. And then ironically, two or three years later, I came up here and my first ever football commentary for Radio Merseyside was Tranmere against Tottenham when Gazza and Gary Lineker were playing.
Yeah.
So again, that was my second day in the job. So there was this love with Tranmere, and as we do this interview now, we're a cycle ride away from Prenton Park. Then I went to Granada TV, and at Granada TV, it was the days where, and people won't believe it now, I think we could only do six games a season on television. There's talk of overkill. Back then, it was maybe every 2 months we'd get a game on the telly. And invariably, it was Tranmere or Bolton Wanderers. So again, there was an association with Tranmere. So it's amazing there are little kind of pockets of things like that.
It's to carry on the football pun, and a completely other end of the pitch to you is, if you don't take chances, you don't deserve to have things. So when these chances have fallen in your lap, you grab them with both hands. The chance to go on and, like, you know, you've done El Clasicos, you've done... regular Premier League commentary, you know, that's all come from that
I say that to my lad now. My lad's just starting off in a media degree, in a media career, should I say. He's joined the BBC the same age as I am, and I'm saying, what you think you're going to be doing now, you definitely won't be doing in 10 years' time. You know, you have a career path, and you want to go somewhere. I mean, you know, the Spanish football happened. I went to Granada TV, and the boss there, Paul Doherty, took me aside one day because we were short of football, and said, I'm going to teach you a skill. Now that you're going to thank me for forevermore. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, doing off-tube commentary. What do you mean? He said, well, you sit in a little room and you commentate off pictures from a satellite position miles and miles away, which is at the time was when Gazzetta dello Sport, James Richardson, Peter Brackley, the guys were doing it in Italian football, and they brought the Spanish football into Sky. And I must say, the first two or three, I hated doing it, commentating off a screen. But then it does become a skill and a way of commentating. It's different. And then when I went from Granada to Sky, I was there a year, and then all of a sudden they get the Spanish football rights and they're looking for somebody to do it. And again, it's off-tube commentary mainly. I don't think we're letting any secrets out of the bag there. Mm-hmm. And just from this kind of chance chat with my boss at Granada, I'm going to hate this, but then you do that. And, you know, we've just been doing Spanish football for 22 years. 22 years of Saturday and Sunday nights, mainly sitting in front of a TV screen commentating on a game 1,800 miles away.
And that ultimately has all come because you've answered the call for help on the football and on the playing side of things. And you can literally chart it all the way back to that moment.
Oh, you can do. And, you know, even things like with the Bridlington Town thing, I met John Motson a couple of years later when I was down in London. And I met him at BA, and he said, what are you doing now? And I'm down here, and we had a good chat. And he said, you don't want to fancy doing some Tottenham games, do you? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I've got, remember Club Call?
Yeah, yeah.
John Motson had a contract to do Club Call, but didn't really like doing it. So I covered for Motty doing Club Call. So that went back from a chance meeting at Bridlington Town. And then from that, I met somebody and they did Arsenal. So I did the big screen at Arsenal. And that's what I say to kids now in the media. I want to do this. Just put yourself out there. You'll knock it. You know, it's like going and selling door to door. You'll knock at 50 doors, eventually might knock at one where somebody wants the product that you've got or they like you. I knocked at a lot of doors, and you know, thankfully some of the doors were opened along the way. But it's it is bizarre, you know, it is crazy. I know I'm not the world's greatest commentator, but there are very few harder working.
If, just to round this off then, if I was having to pin you down, because trying to get a memory out of you at the start was quite hard until ironically this fell into your lap again.
Yeah.
If I had to pin you down for what if there was one game that you would be thankful for that all this has happened, that you could go back and revisit out of all the games that you've done, because I know you've done, you know, your tribute to the late great Peter Brackley quite recently was about how much you learned from him in terms of, I think it was World Cup games in 94. And all the class coaches you've done, all the Spanish football that you've done, all the Premier League stuff that you've done, if there's any real game I could nail you down for, what would it be?
Do you know what? I'm useless. If you ask me what I did last weekend, somebody asked me on Sunday what the score was on Saturday night. I did it Italy-Portugal, I think it was 0-0, and I couldn't remember Sunday morning.
Yeah,
and
then they say 1-1.
Was it 1-0?
No, I needed 1-0 for a bit of money.
And honestly, my best pal, and again, you know, you talk about coincidences, my best pal in sport is Rob Hawthorne. Who's now a Sky commentator. We went for the same job at Radio Humberside in 86, I think. And they actually interviewed me on his CV and him on my CV.
Right.
And then my side of the story is they said, tell us about what you've done at Radio WM. And I'm like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
You are Rob. She said, Rob Hawthorne, no. Don't worry about it. Yeah. Rob claims it's when they got to the weight section. They made a mistake. So Rob and I have this conversation quite often. I'll call him on and say, how was the game last night? And he won't remember what he did. And I go, but it was City United, it was 3-3. Oh, yeah. And you input so much information that when you output, it's really, really difficult. I'm padding now because I can't remember a single game.
I'm trying to think of,
do you know that one of my final ones was in radio, which would be Liverpool 4, Everton 4, FA Cup?
Yeah.
And that was, that was a monumental one because we went there. I think it's still Panto season. I still remember my mate Marcus Buckland, who called just before we did this interview. And we started it with it's Panto season. Tommy Smith and Brian LeBone, Ugly Sisters, We've Got Our Own. And he always reminds me of that. And it was the 4-4. And then probably 10 days later, Kenny Dalglish went. We got the call in the morning from Liverpool. Instead of getting down at 12, can you get here at 10? I got down there. So, it's all around the game rather than the single game. He scored in this minute, he scored in that minute. It was about the feeling at the time because we'd been out the night before. We'd done the 4-4. It was a really busy time of the year. Marcus and I had been out. I think he was staying at mine. Got a call from Liverpool. Can you come down? Well, can we come at 12? No, you need to be here at 10. And we got there. And the guy in the gate said, you're not going to believe this. Well, Kenny's resigned.
Yeah.
You joke. I'm unshaven. You know, 23, 24 years of age at the time. And I had to sit there at the front of the press conference with my microphone. If you ever see a shot of Kenny Dalglish, this is a guy with hair all over the place, unshaven, with his arm. Because the guy had told me, and I knew it to be true, I knew this guy was trustworthy.
Yeah.
I think the press conference was due to start about 11:05. I went on Radio Merseyside and they said, breaking news. And I didn't tell them what it was. And I saw King Kenny of the Cop has abdicated. And I took a real gamble. And I say, thankfully, because I didn't want Kenny Dalglish to live. But I got, you know, that was my exclusive. So it was, again, all around that game, rather than the specifics of a game. You ask me the specifics and I can't remember them. I listen now and people say on YouTube, oh, I've got a clip of this. I haven't got a clue.
Who scored Everton's equalisers at the end?
I can remember Barnsley flying one in past Neville Southall. Go on, who's got it?
Tony Cotty.
Did he?
Came on. You were at the game.
No idea.
But as a commentator, it's been a great laugh.
Oh, it's brilliant. Oh, yeah, it's great. I mean, you know, you look around here, and at the moment, there are so many games to do. But it's good fun. And, every year's a challenge this year because we've lost the Spanish football. I'm doing more Football League. And that's harder work because you don't know the players. And I'm doing this. I did Juventus against AC Milan the other week for a Canadian broadcaster. Wonderful to do that. I've just been asked to do a Monaco, Lyon, I think, in a couple of weeks' time. So again, it's just like picking up a book and you have to learn from scratch. Whereas, you know, I've loved doing the Spanish, but it's hard work. The best bit is doing it, the 90 minutes of doing it. The other side is implanting all that info. I wish there's a chip you could put in and out like you do on a computer. But yeah, it's brilliant. Well, I suppose the game I've chosen, and I've got to admit, I've got to look back at the specifics of it, which will become apparent in a second. I'll never forget the day. It was the 10th of July, 1994, the World Cup. And I now know, because I'm just Wikipedia-ing it, what did we say, it was round of 16?
Yeah.
But you'll understand why I'm vague, because I'd gone over to America. I was desperate to commentate in the World Cup in the United States, because I'd been educated out there, and I played football in the States in the college system, owed a lot to it. And I went back for 8 or 9 years to coach, but I wanted to be there, and I hadn't been chosen for the ITV team. I was a rookie, but I wrote to the head of sport and said, look, if you're short, here's my address. I think we had emails back then. This is how to get hold of me. And I was coaching in Minnesota, got a call from Trevor East, who was the head of sport, and he said, we're short of a commentator to do the off-tube games that are going to be on the BBC, and we'll show them in highlight form, but we've also got a contract to do it for the world as well, for the world feed. Would you come down to Dallas? So I says, yeah. He knew I would. There was plane tickets already booked for 8 o'clock the next morning. I went down the next day, which I guess was the back end of June, and went down and worked with the great Peter Brackley, the great, sadly late Peter Brackley, who died a couple of weeks ago. Brack has welcomed me. Brack is to do one game, and then I'd go in and do the next game. He was mad. He was the king of the off tubes, which we were talking about before. He literally decorated the off tube suite. So each day we'd bring something in. So after 3 weeks, he would just have pictures and had stats and all stuff there. And it looked like the set of fantasy football. It was mad. And I got as far as, I now know, Romania against Sweden when I was commentating and doing an off tube. And it went to extra time, and it went to penalties. It finished 2-2, and I'm reading this off Wikipedia now. And then it went to penalties, and I'm guessing that Sweden won, and Ravelli was the hero. So we finished that, and I got back home, and that should have been the pinnacle of my career. I'd worked the only World Cup I've worked on, actually, and we got to almost the quarterfinal stage where I was due to be commentating. And as I got back to the hotel room, the phone was flashing on the answer phone in the hotel, and there's a message from my mother-in-law saying, ring urgently, you've become a dad to twins. Now, we weren't expecting to become parents until October,
right.
And this was the 10th of July. So I called up, and mother-in-law said, yeah, Beau's gone into labour. You got two, well, she said two girls at first, but she meant two boys.
easy mistake.
He's
easy
listening mistake. In, yeah. He's listening in. And they were severely premature, and it did prove to be life and death. So I had to leave. In fact, that night we went out and played football. I couldn't get from Dallas. We played football the next morning. I had to fly back to Minneapolis to get my passport. And I came home. Very long story. Ellis is sitting behind us listening now. He's done brilliantly. But his brother Jonathan, they were twins, our twins. And Jonathan battled for 4 months and sadly lost his life and didn't make it. Ellis has made me very, very proud. The reason, I don't remember the specifics of the game, because obviously everything around that time is a blur. But and he hates this when I tell this story. His brother Jonathan was Jonathan Rhys Ravelli, named after the goalkeeper who I'd worked out was saving the penalties in the World Cup the moment he was born.
Right, okay.
And as I left the commentary booth, Peter Brackley said, you've got to name your son after our commentary booth, which was like within the spirit of it then. So poor old Ellis behind me is known as Ellis Robert Boothroyd Palmer. He absolutely hates that. But I said when Brack is in, I died a couple of weeks ago, and there are a lot of plaudits for him and a lot of memories. I said, well, you know, at least now you can read about the great man that you were kind of jokingly named after. So when you're talking about games, it was probably the pinnacle of my international commentating career, but also, you know, the turning point of my life to become a dad to two kids. And very proud of the young man behind me now is following me into the broadcasting business with the BBC.
Following your Twitter feed, you're not just saying that because he is behind you and has the potential to start ram raiding you with his wheelchair.
Yeah.
You know, which I'm sure, yeah, given any opportunity, Alice, yeah, you would probably do. But that, what you're talking about here is almost sort of the absolute antithesis to what we've spoken about in your memory, which was all these, and I'm going to be very careful my words here, but I think when I say all these, one after the other great things happen.
Yeah.
This is not necessarily the case that whilst, you know, you've got your son here who you're very proud of.
Yeah.
You've gone from the high of actually setting out with a goal achieving that goal, and then basically life getting in the way. Is that?
Well, it puts life into context, doesn't it? It's one of those moments, and I see people in my business that stress, and it's not. It's just a job. You talk about football, and you ask people questions, and it's an entertainment business. And at the end of the day, you're there to promote the product and to entertain people. You know, you read Twitter, and people get upset about football. It's an escape from reality. You know, and that. Oh, I don't get what you said before. Do you get nervous? No, I don't. You just go in there and you're talking about a football match. And, you know, if I was going and talking about volleyball or chess or something I didn't know about, then I'd be nervous because I'd just be making it up. But, you know, you've done your work. So, no, it's an escape from life. And then, you know, a moment like that on the 10th of July, 1994, should have been the greatest moment of my career at that point. But everything is overshadowed, and it's all a bit of a blur. And intentionally, until tonight, when we Wikipedia'd and Googled it, I didn't know the specifics. I couldn't remember who they were playing. I knew it was Sweden. I knew they were going to play Bulgaria. And I remember it was a decent Romania team as well. I knew it was penalties because all that was important, but it was completely unimportant in the greater kind of spectrum of things.
At what point did you said you had the flashing? Were you, when you got back to the hotel room and when you've done this? How much, if you don't mind me asking, how much was the crash from? I mean, obviously
you don't. You know, if I really didn't realise, we went up, and I only went up because I was missing a pair of socks. I had everything else with me, and I went to get a pair of socks. Otherwise, I might have been 3 or 4 hours later.
Yeah.
And those days there were no mobile phones, and nobody. So it was only by pure chance I saw the light flashing on the room, and then I went down, and they're going, "Where have you been? Come on, the coach is going." I said, "Well, I've just become a dad." What? Oh, it's kind of months away. Well, one of the other guys is expecting I think it was a daughter he eventually got at roughly the same time. And we've been kind of clothes shopping for babies and stuff like that. But you're buying for babies that are 8 and 9 pounds. Junior behind me is £1.14 when he was born, and his brother's £1.12. So you couldn't prepare for any of that. And the bizarre thing was, we went off and it was ITV and BBC against the foreign broadcasters. And I played in goal and played a football match. So there was still a normality to that night. Then we had this incredible thunder and lightning, and the game was called off after 60 minutes. It was like nothing was normal. Mm. Then we went and had a Chinese, and I think I was powerless because I couldn't get out of Dallas, and my passport was in Minnesota because I'd been rushed to Dallas to do the game, thinking I can get back at a leisurely pace. And time kind of, and I still remember, and it's somewhere in the house, getting Dr. Spock's book on raising babies, which was the thing at the time. But there was nothing in there about 16-week or 15-week premature babies. So nothing was normal. So, you know, as I say before, it's a little bit like the job. You've got to prepare, but you know, you've got to be prepared for absolutely everything at the same time as well.
How surreal was it at the time? Were you self-aware of the sort of surrealness of you're ostensibly in a very famous, beautiful city.
Yeah.
Having the time of your life.
Yeah, yeah.
But in reality, you need to be, how many thousand miles back, wherever?
Yeah, I had to go from being the most disciplined I'd ever been, because I was learning World Cup teams and players from scratch, not expecting to work on the World Cup, and coming back from a game and then doing my homework on the next one and preparing and going in, to just literally dropping everything and getting on a plane and coming back. You know, and a little bit of black humour. The lads are in Arrow Park, and, you know, in between checks and things like that, we go into the parents' room, and I remember watching the World Cup final a week after, and watching that from the parents' room. So the World Cup, that was the other, can be being detached from the World Cup, but still wanted to kind of round it all off. But no, I mean, the kind of 3 or 4 months that we had with Ellis and Jonathan was just kind of a blur as well. And there were things that, you know, my wife tells me and I tell her about stuff that happened then, but neither of us can really remember either. Mm. So
Do you remember the World Cup final? Because that for me would be one of the biggest tragedies, that out of all these things that have happened, you remember one of the worst games we've ever seen.
That was the penalty, wasn't it, Badger?
Oh, it was awful. Yeah. Awful game.
Yeah. I'm glad it was awful, because Ellis was on a machine and hooked up to all kinds of life-saving bits and bobs, measuring heart, and you could understand, you could literally hear the heartbeats, and he was on oxygen, so he wasn't breathing for himself at the time. So you could hear all that in the background. So I'm glad it was a boring game, so I could very occasionally disappear from the game and then go in and check on the lads in the incubation units, in the special care baby units. If it had been 5-5, I might have had a few dilemmas as to what I did, but no, they made it easy for me.
I mean, it's an incredible story, but I suppose that the wider point for me is that, you know, I've I lost a parent very, very young, and there's been times when I'm trying to think where I my dad died when I was six, and we were going through pretty bad time, I think, because it is a memory I have. I have a very, I think I'm almost sort of OCD when it comes to memory. But I just want to play football. Yeah. I remember playing, I'd go out and play football pretty much soon. I remember my mum telling me, it's almost like remembering the beauty of what you've done is, do you think that kind of, particularly with Jonathan, do you think that helped heal you? Do you think it helped going back out and doing, as you say, something normal?
Oh, that's deep, isn't it? Isn't that deep?
Not with me.
It's the deepest we've ever been.
Yeah, dear me, we're getting deep. Well, do you know, my boss at the time was a guy called Paul Doherty, who was the hardest man in television. I mean, he's the only man I've seen that Alex Ferguson cower to.
Right.
And Sir Alex owes his job to Paul because he persuaded the Edwards family to keep Alex Ferguson in a job till the infamous FA Cup game. So this guy was frightening. He discovered Ron Atkinson as a broadcaster.
Yeah.
I remember, I don't think it was that well, it was the previous World Cup, Italia. Ron Atkinson calling Paul at half time to see how he was doing, and Paul giving Ron Atkinson a pep talk on his World Cup commentary. So this was a hard man, but his heart was melted, and they were so supportive with Ellis and Jonathan. But you know, again, you talk about the job being an escapism. We lost Jonathan in November of 94, and I was off work, and understandably, and then they had one of the very rare live games that we had on ITV at the time, Burnley, probably Tranmere. And they said, do you want to come back? And I said, yeah, I do. And it was in between Jonathan passing away and his funeral. And it probably wasn't a wise thing to do, but you just need to get out of the loop. So I went off and I commentated doing what you enjoy doing. But again, nothing's ever easy. When we got to Burnley, the commentary position was behind the goal because they were rebuilding the main stand. So it's the only time in doing this job for 30 years that I've commentated on a game from behind a goal where you cannot see the pitch. So it was the most trying of circumstances. So again, you kind of, you got to smile at it. But again, the guys at Granada, Rob McCaffrey and Elton Wellesby and the lads from back then, they helped us live through that and get through it. And Paul was brilliant. But you know, that's why when you said before, football's a near game. It's a bit of fun.
I mean, I am good friends with, or certainly good professional friends with Paul Kendrick.
Yeah.
From Wigan.
Yeah.
And obviously you see all the work that he does with Joseph's Goal. And I think I kind of put the same question to him about how has football helped him during that time. And he kind of thinks he just sees Joseph getting on with it. And you look at how much, and I'm not just asking you because he's here, but is Alisson inspiration because of how hard he's fought to get where he is?
Well, if you say inspirational, ram that microphone down your throat. he hates that word. Do not call me an inspiration.
Okay.
He wants to talk now. Like he's not
I'm not going to talk.
I understand because
couldn't be proud because you know when Ellis has got cerebral palsy, which is basically part of the brain is damaged. You know, being blunt, isn't it? When Ellis was very young, they showed him a picture of his brain at Alder Hey. And we realised how smart he was. Then he went, look at me, Dad, I've got 18 brains. Because there's a picture of his brain from every hour. Oh, this kid's different. You know, and most dads would want their lad to go off and play football. And when I look at people now and seeing their sons play football, I'm the opposite of jealous. I look and I think, is that all you've got? But I look at him and see what he's done. You know, we didn't know whether he was going to walk, whether he was going to talk. He doesn't walk, but he never shuts up talking. It's the longest he's ever been without talking. And, you know, we didn't know Ellis was because he was born almost 4 months early. He was a year ahead of himself at school because he was taken in with the September lot when he shouldn't have been born till October, if you get my drift. Mm-hmm. So the first 10 years or so, he was always a bit behind and catching up. And now he's a proper academic. You know, and you can ask him about. He's the opposite of me. He retains everything. Ask him about any country or politics, and he will give you it carte blanche. So I'm really, really proud of him. And you know, now he's gone into the broadcasting business, and he's been at the BBC years doing TV stuff. He's doing radio stuff. He's doing online stuff. He understands the whole digital revolution, which he's going to be taking part over the next 10 years, better than anybody that I know. So yeah, I couldn't be prouder than him. You know. I know other got mates whose lads have kicked a ball around for a few years and, you know, been released and made it to a certain level, but they're not going to do in the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm.
I look at him and he's, you know, he's gone off to a red brick university. He's been over to Barcelona to do his masters. He's come back to the BBC, and already in that same age, that I had a lot of varieties having it as well. He thinks he knows where he's going, but I ain't got a clue.
No. But he'll never have Romania versus Sweden, which until 17 minutes ago, you didn't know you had either.
If Ellis had Romania against Sweden, he would remember every penalty taker the minute things happen and the yellow cards.
But that's the beauty of football, isn't it? That sometimes actually remembering everything isn't part of the fun. Remembering, remembering that Rivelli was the penalty saving. Can you describe what Thomas Rivelli looked like?
Oh yeah, I can picture him.
Yeah, yeah.
Slightly tanned with the hair. I mean, the other moment, and again, you came here expecting me to talk about matches that I've commentated on. They're immaterial.
Yeah.
I mean, the other moment is, and Ellis is now a Man City fan, but that's another story, is going to Istanbul. And we managed to get tickets through Liverpool to go to Istanbul. And Ellis came with me. It was the day he just got his... Was it your first electric chair?
Yeah, it would have been, yeah.
His first lightweight electric chair cost about $8,000.
Yeah.
And we had to kind of throw it in on a plane, get into Istanbul, got it in and out of taxis that were not designed for wheelchairs. We went to we had a brilliant, the best ever lads and dads time you're ever going to have. Went to the game. And 2005, how old would you be?
10, 11.
Yeah, 11.
10 going on 11, yeah.
Yeah, 10 going on 11. And still, you know, still a kid.
I mean, I don't want to point this out to social services, Rob, but he should have been in school.
I think that special it was May, wasn't it? A special dispensation. I mean, he's really suffered. and then at half time, 3-0 down, we went to the toilet, and I remember him saying, Dad, they'll come back in the second half. And I said, look, listen, son, it doesn't quite happen like that. No, they will. I've got this feeling, Dad, they will. And of course, Liverpool came back and won. But he knew it.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you talk about those special little moments. You know, and can ask me about Messi scoring a hat-trick or Ronaldo scoring a wonder goal or the Ronaldo goal against Compostela or all the goals you've done or the Rooney first goal and stuff like that. Or Messi's first goal. But that's probably more magical and really kind of from the heart. That's work, but that was from the heart him telling me, I wish I put a bet on it. And then we were the first ones back in the airport because they took all the wheelchair users back to the airport with a police escort, and there's typically the Liverpool fans that have left at half time. You go, you know what happened? Yes, mate, we do. Yeah, yeah. So again, those are people say to me, oh, you're not a fan. My best moments are ones where I'm a fan rather than where I've got a microphone sitting in front of me.
There you go. Quite an emotional chat. Kevin Day, in his podcast, complained that he couldn't make me cry, or if he'd known it was about making me cry, he'd have tried harder. Rob didn't have to try. I must admit, I did well up during his moment, as you can imagine. Just thanks again to Rob for his time. I think it's absolutely fantastic. And Ellis was great to chat. And I definitely think give both Rob and Ellis a follow and see how they go in life. It was mad to hear just how Rob's one of the few people in the world who tried to combine a media and football career at the same time. Wondering about his voiceover while he's probably coming for a cross. It was great. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you did too. If that is the last of our series, then great. You know, thank you very much for everybody that's listening. Thanks to everybody that's retweeted. And I hope you all have a fantastic few weeks. But I might see you next week.